Okay, so this is consumer litigation and bankruptcy. We'll try to get to it. I wanted to bring to your attention that included in the materials are a number of forms. And I thought we would start, and we're going to get there eventually, I promise, start by talking about some of these forms and some comments that we all have about those forms. The first one is an adversary proceeding turnover. And I'll confess that in the Western District, and I don't think I'm alone in this regard, if you want to get your car back, you can file a motion. The rules require, it's an action to recover a piece of property, so that should require an adversary proceeding, which you then would have to include with a motion for a temporary restraining order to get the car back. But as far as I'm concerned, you need your car back, you need it back today. File a motion, I'll set a hearing, and if the circumstances are correct, I'll let you get your car back.
There are other divisions that do require that it be done by adversary proceeding, not motion. So keep an eye on your local jurisdiction. And let's face facts. 99.99999% of turnovers in a consumer case are going to be for cars. Most, though not all of them, from Tote the Note car lots. So we've just got an adversary proceeding as your first document seeking turnover. Judge, how quickly will you set hearing on an emergency motion for turnover or an adversary for turnover?
As fast as you can get notice to the, whatever you call that car lot.
Yes. Tote the note is the word we're going to use, okay, instead of my customary word that begins with C-R-A-P.
I mean, notice and some opportunity for them to get a lawyer to the court.
Okay. And then we'll deal with these some more in more detail as we're going through our PowerPoint presentation. Obviously, any request for damages, sanctions, and attorney's fees is not going to be heard on an expedited basis. What will be heard on an expedited basis is, do they have to give me the car back?
And we had a discussion at lunch about this, giving the car back. I mean, I will require insurance. And to me, I mean, you could go through and say, well, that's an adequate protection issue. That should require a motion to be filed. You can get technical about it. As far as I'm concerned, the secured lender is entitled to have the car insured. And assuming that that's your car and the circumstances are correct, you're entitled to get the car. And so I'm going to do whatever I can to get to the point of telling them to give the car back and telling you to get it insured as quickly as possible.
And, Judge, where in the code does it say that adequate protection applies to turnover? Is that not a lift-stay issue, not a turnover issue?
Let's just say it's my issue.
And the judges before whom I appear won't even require turnover until there's insurance. But I don't see it anywhere in the code. I think it's still a stay violation. But
I think
doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think in the Southern that you've got to give the car back with or without the insurance. But they have to go get the insurance, so.
Right. Now, granted, even if they were ordered to turn it over, then I think that there could be an emergency motion for stay relief for the lack of insurance. So you probably have a very practical result, Judge.
Well, it's actually selfish. I want there to be as few hearings as possible.
Okay, and then the next document we have are the disclosures. Rule 26 requires that disclosures be filed in any adversary proceeding. You know, since the plaintiff started the party, they get to start with their disclosures. The one big tip I'd have on that is don't forget to amend it as you go along. You may, 2 months into a case, hire an expert witness. Well, if you don't amend your disclosures to list and disclose that witness, you may very well be unable to call them at trial, or the argument could be made. Judge, how important are these disclosures that, frankly, as a debtor's practitioner, I just view as something that's got to be done?
Yeah, it's got to be done, but it gets the information out on the table. And I think that's helpful both in terms of allowing both sides to prepare for trial, but maybe more importantly, it's helpful to starting the discussion that might ultimately resolve the matter through settlement. But I think they're critical. The one thing I'll mention, that there are a lot of deadlines out there that, you know, once a complaint's filed, that get triggered and start running. Many of those deadlines are covered by the form of pretrial order. If you want to craft your own pretrial order by agreement with the other party, I'm a big fan of that. I think that's fantastic. That gets you talking to the other side, and you can craft a pretrial order that will actually work in the context of whatever you're litigating about. But the one disclosure that frequently is not, and I've seen people get tripped up by this, and I had to email my Sarah Wood, my law clerk, to find out what the rule was, because I didn't remember what it was, but it's Rule 26-2D, and at least 90 days before the date set for trial is when you need to disclose your expert witness. And again, that doesn't usually show up, and I've had that happen in an adversary proceeding where the expert witness doesn't get disclosed by the deadline, and the other side says, hey, they haven't been disclosed, I haven't had a chance. Now, I'm going to find some way probably to let them get the expert in, but the other side's going to have an opportunity to take a deposition. There's going to have to be a report prepared on a timely basis. It creates difficulties in terms of getting that process done, getting your expert hired, and making it all happen before the trial happens. So that's just an example of the kind of deadlines that are contained within the rules, may or may not be within the scheduling order, that you need to pay attention to once that adversary gets filed.